Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to another edition of Rick and Bubba University, the podcast. Now, this is a unique podcast that we do most every week. We do a daily show, Bubba, a lot of Rick and Bubba content out there. Monday through Friday, if you're not familiar with that, just go to Rick and Bubba, spell out the word and.com to find out more. So on Rick and Bubba University today, Bubba, you've got to be thrilled. We are going into the world of NASA. Tony Casey, who did appear on the big show during the week, and has just completed a really cool expedition involving the solar eclipse back in early April. And Tony Casey will join us now on Rick and Bubba University, the podcast. Tony, welcome.
Tony.
Thank you guys for having me. Really, really a pleasure to be here.
Well, we thank you for taking time. I know you guys are busy. You got a lot going on, but it was so interesting what you were doing during the eclipse. We wanted to talk to you a little more about it and learn a little more about you and who you are and how all this plays together. So I guess to begin with, just to kind of set the stage for everybody, tell us about you and how you got to NASA.
Yeah, how'd this happen?
Okay, so that's a great question. I normally wake up thanking my dear Lord and Savior for every day and wondering how it happened.
Yeah.
But I went to school at Auburn University after just a high school in a small town in North Alabama, Haleville. And I, you know, left with a science degree, physics, and I really didn't know what I was going to do with that. And through just kind of a lot of random opportunities that were put in front of me, including kind of making my own interview with the company at the time with Southern Research, I just kind of called this guy up. People were giving me a lead, and I said, hey, I hear you got a job. And I walked in, and he handed me a description, asked me if I could do it, and I said no, but I could figure it out real quick. And they put me on there about 03, and I've been just working my way through whatever opportunities presented themselves. That included a trip to Afghanistan to work with this plane in 2012 just as a sensor expert, and then an opportunity to move out to Houston in 2014 to work with it every day. And then I let them know I was looking to, hey, you know, if y'all need another guy in the back seat there, I'd be happy to. So I got to start flying in 2020, and I love it. It's a great part of the job. It's not like it's the only part of the job. You don't just get to show up every day and fly around and come back down. There's a whole lot of other things everybody does here, and just proud to be able to fit in where I can get in.
It sounds like you just wouldn't take no for an answer. You just kept calling people and showing up, right?
Yeah, show up, raise your hand, step forward, do the best you can. And just keep showing up the next day.
Well, when you start working, you mentioned the plane. What you're talking about is the WB-57.
Yeah, give us a little history of that plane, because I know it's got quite a history.
It's a crazy unique history as well. It's something that either people are huge fans of this plane and they're like, oh, I've always wanted to see one of these, or what the heck is that thing? It's one of the two, and it is a modified bomber, so hence the B. It was a B-57. The U.S. Air Force in the Southeast Asia theater after Korea came out of that, and they said, we don't have a jet bomber, and we really need one. And they looked at all the U.S. designs, and they were not happy with any of the options. Britain flew a couple of Canberras over, which was kind of like the master model for what it came to be, and then they modified that and Americanized it and made a B-57. That was the first jet bomber to drop ordnance in warfare. That happened in Vietnam. And then after the Vietnam theater, and I forget how many hundreds were made and used there. But after that, in the late 60s, early 70s, they modified 21 with this long wing modification. Because the original B-57, it was just your standard short wing, medium range, could carry a lot of weight, but it wasn't the high altitude beast that we fly in today. So the Air Force modified the Bs to be RB, reconnaissance B-57s. And they were doing air sampling and atmospheric sampling. And they actually had an auxiliary little engine that would fire up to help get them up to, say, 70,000. I know they were very interested in what was going on east of Russia around that time point, if you want to think about what everybody was doing about that time and testing things. And so when the Air Force started to retire them, NASA said, hey, those look pretty handy for science and research, and we can do all kinds of things with them. And there was a partnership that was developed. And so as of right now, we've got the last three flying WBs. We got the last flying ones. There is one original B-57 still flying in England. I think it belongs to a museum over there. But as far as WBs or RBs, this is the last three. So that's how they are. Now, what NASA uses them for, basically we use them for anything that we can help with. And that means they're a high altitude, up to 62, 63,000 feet. They're a research platform. So if you've got something you need to test that might go on a U-2 or a Global Hawk or maybe even into orbit, but it's not miniaturized and small enough and automated enough yet, we can put it on the WB. We can get it up in the 60s for you. And we can test it out. We can put atmospheric science on there. We did a really cool mission to the Arctic last year, pun intended, and did a lot of atmospheric sampling and science. Got one of the neatest views I've ever seen up there. And then we also have this big camera turret system that was built for return to flight back in the 04, 05 time period. And it continues to be modified and upgraded. And we use it for looking at things, whether that's a shuttle launch, a capsule return, or in April 8th. 2024 the eclipse.
Tony, I guess that's where I'm familiar with the WB-57. I think the company you went to work for, I knew some folks there when they were on the return to flight mission with the space shuttle, where they were actually going up and videoing the space shuttle coming back into the atmosphere. And that's amazing how they could do that, and at that height and at those speeds.
Yeah, the technology to track the shuttle is really an interesting feat. I mean, from launch upward is pretty easy because that's you know where it's starting from, and then you can track it and go from there.
Right.
Getting these capsules, how they ever got any video back then, I don't know, quite frankly. these days, everybody's got it down to such a science. They give us a trajectory of location, time, and place to where it's going to be here when it comes over the horizon, and normally it's pretty accurate. So we can load that in the system. It points us to the right spot in the sky to start with. And then our job is to zoom in on it, center it up, and track it all the way down to there.
So that's some amazing optics that you're talking about. And to be able to do it at that speed, at that height, that's more than an iPhone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The optics are insane, but the stability is what really makes it work.
Right.
The pilot's putting us in the right spot, of course, because I can't do anything if the pilot's not got me where I need to be, looking the way that I need to look. So I guess a little credit to those guys. You know, they kind of know what they're doing.
pretty skilled.
The absolute best pilots there are. The optics are huge, and they've been modified, and they continue to grow. Optics technology is growing. But we're dealing with limited space. So it's like a 33-inch diameter sphere. How much optics can you put in there and still make it work? How much can you modify it and still make it stable? And that a single person can operate. So the system that we used for the eclipse has six different cameras on it. So I'm sitting there trying to zoom and focus and check exposure and all the things you do with cameras on six different cameras simultaneously. Mm.
Tony, tell everybody, too, a little bit why the eclipse was such an important time to try to study our sun.
So the eclipse offers a really neat opportunity to try to understand the biggest mystery of the sun, as I understand it, which is why is the atmosphere or the corona around the sun way warmer than the surface of the sun itself? So when they've done studies that say, hey, what is the temperature of the sun? It's on the order of thousands of degrees. Mm. I don't even think the unit matters. We'll say Celsius. But then the atmosphere around it is millions, multiple millions of degrees. So it's kind of counterintuitive. It's like walking away from a campfire or a heat source and getting warmer as you back away. So that doesn't make a lot of sense right away. And you can't really study that atmosphere when the brightness of the surface of the sun is basically just outglowing everything else. So you can't then study the dimmer portion, which is then the hotter portion. So when the eclipse gets in the way, just the right size moon, just the right size distance. Then it creates this awesome opportunity to go and collect this data on the sun. And the benefit of doing it in the WB, we were at 50,000 feet because if you go above that, you got to wear like a full pressure suit. It's very awkward and bulky, yeah, and it's hard to do things. Is you're above all the atmosphere, and the atmosphere scatters light. that's why the sky is blue. It scatters some wavelengths more than others. And so the infrared, the midwave infrared in particular, could possibly tell us a lot. So we flew the one in 2017. It was the first time a midwave sensor had gotten above the atmosphere and looked at the sun. It was an idea from Southwest Research Institute. The guy's name was Amir Caspi that was leading the charge. And he said, let's see if we can get some neat data on this. We've already got these sensors. Let's fly them. And got funding to do so. And so we went up and flew it, and it really revealed a lot. And so on this one, we've got some more science calibrated level midwave cameras and a shortwave and a near IR. And so getting up above all that scattering, I don't even know what they've learned yet. I know that there are some images. I have seen them. I passed some of them along to Adler so he can drop those in. But the science that they're going to get out of it, they probably haven't even really gotten into it yet. I know they studied that 2017 eclipse for 4 or 5 years. I mean, really just deep dive into every pixel and what does it tell you?
We'll come back. We're going to continue our conversation with Tony Casey and get into, like you said, this is going to go on for years, them studying this. But we'll talk a little bit about what he was able to just see being part of this flight back when the solar eclipse happened in earlier April, and continue to talk to him on this edition of Rick and Bubba University, the podcast.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This is the Rick and Bubba Show. Watch more at blazetv.com/Rick and Bubba.
Rick and Bubba, Rick and Bubba.
Here we are on Rick and Bubba University, continuing our conversation with Tony Casey. And Tony, you were there, and these images that you sent us to look at, just the view of the Northern Lights. My goodness.
Amazing. Yeah. We'll look at those, and those are, well, we're looking at one of them right now. Yeah. To be. This, and Tony, I think you said this was from another mission over the Arctic. That's incredible. You're not just seeing the Northern Lights, you're in it.
Yeah, it didn't even dawn on me at first, honestly. Another one of the pictures I sent to Adler was an Arctic sunset, because we had taken off a little before sundown, a couple hours before sundown, and we went from, we were based out of Alston Air Force Base in Alaska near Fairbanks. And kind of went north and east. So then we're on the return flying south and west. And, you know, the shape of the Earth up there, just the sunset just took forever. And I'm monitoring like 17 different atmospheric science instruments, collecting data and doing this. And if they have a problem, they'll show me a red light and I'll figure out what to do. But everything was clicking along. And I was like, man, that sunset, that's going to go down in a minute. I'm going to have to adjust my cockpit. And then it just kept lasting and kept lasting. So I took a few pictures of that. And then it goes down, and just taking a survey, trying to self-assess in the big pressure suit. Sometimes you got to eat some food through a tube or other things that you do. And my pilot goes, are those the Northern Lights off our left side? And the sunset had been over to the right. And I go, and they were so dim at first because the sun had just barely gone down. Yeah. I wasn't even sure. Then you pull my phone out and start taking pictures, and just automatically set the exposure. So, hey, credit to the iPhone for doing that.
Oh, yeah.
And it just takes this shot. And wow. So I've got a lot of instruments back there and screens and other things that are all emitting light. And I basically said, well, everything looks like it's working okay. I'm just going to turn everything off that's making light and try to get some really cool selfies. And if they need me, they'll call me on the voice line.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, did one with the visor down so that it'd kind of be like, yeah, a little more. It's not just me. You know, not everybody wants to look at this beautiful face every day. Because we got some shots from different missions in our room, in our offices and things like that. And, you know, you want some ambiguity sometimes as to who it is. Or yeah. Sometimes you don't. So I took both options there.
Tony, I know in a basketball game, when you have a big dunk over somebody, they say that you posterize somebody. And I would have to say that shot with the Northern Lights that you're up there all up in it is a poster, man. That is really, really cool.
Yeah, there was one other guy that flew through the Northern Lights while we were up there. We did like, I think, 12 science missions, 12 science flights over 6 weeks when we were there. I haven't seen any of his shots. I don't know. Maybe he just knew mine were so much better, he just didn't even bother. I'm not saying this case, but I don't have any evidence to the contrary.
So when you're in that, I would, looking at it and the way you've described it, when you're actually in your part of the WB 57, I would think if you're claustrophobic, this job is not for you. It's a tight space, isn't it?
It's a tight space, and you probably wouldn't even make it through a lot of the training if you were claustrophobic. The jet itself isn't too bad. I mean, let's say I'm a bigger guy. I'm about 5 pounds below the weight limit of the ejection seat, which is 245. I hang out right in the 240 region, so I'm for sure filling up all the space back there. And then I put the pressure suits on; it's even more so. But just in that suit itself, you're in like your own little environment. You close that lid, and you're breathing your own oxygen. Your body's getting its own air. You're not even pulling air from the outside until they hook you to the jet, and then a ram air kind of keeps some air moving. So when you move around in it, you get hot really fast, and you can get to fight, and you got to just stop, take a deep breath, and go through it.
But you got to stay calm, don't you? You got to be able to calm yourself, don't you?
One of the things I've always taught my kids when they were playing softball or doing anything else was that smooth is faster than fast. It was always my expression. You know, you've heard smooth is slow and smooth is fast. But I forget. But my version of it is that smooth is faster than fast. If you try to do anything fast in that suit, it's just going to go wrong. If you just plan your movements and do them slowly, then you'll get the job done.
Tony, let me ask you this. You're a scientist. You know what the northern lights are, that they're actually particles coming from our sun that hits the magnetic field, and some of them get through, some of them don't, and you're at the part of the world where more of them get through. But it's an eerie feeling. I saw the part of the northern lights one time, but it's such an eerie feeling when you see them, even though we know what they are. For you to be up there flying with that was it as eerie to you as it is to us on the ground who've seen them before?
I don't know if I would use the word eerie. For me, it was just more spectacular.
Right.
I was just another one of those moments of awe. I don't ever lose sight of the fact of why am I here?
Right.
Because, okay, a little bit more, I guess, to touch back on my backstory. So I'm getting a physics degree from Auburn, right? Which is not typical from a guy from small town Alabama, but my family, my dad, I mean, they're great. I'd come home the first couple of summers actually. And, they said, hey, you need a summer job. You're going to come up here and make some money. And so I went to work in the mobile home plants. He had connections there. His whole family has been suppliers to that world. And so I'd be out on the floor building mobile homes in the summer. And he tells me the first time, he goes, I don't think I'd tell anybody you're getting like a big physics or science degree. You're getting, just tell them you're down there doing vet stuff or something. You know, it's just, you got to be able to embrace both sides of it. And being there was just, it's just awesome. It kind of the same attitude I carried the whole time I was in college. I sent another picture to Adler. You know, a lot of people have two jobs while they're in college, trying to scrape up a little side money. And pretty common, if you've got a hard field that you're studying, you'll tutor people in that field. Well, as a physics guy, I'm going to be a physics tutor. Then the other skill set that I had, because I was always raised with horses and competitions and doing different things, was my dad taught me how to shoe horses. So I could shoe horses and I could tutor physics. So I had just one card because I couldn't afford to make two different ones. So a farrier and physics tutor, one big bright orange card at the feed store and at the physics offices.
I don't know how many people leave their card at the feed store and the physics office. Yeah, I don't know. You may be the only person that ever has pulled that off.
Tony, let me ask you too, back to the eclipse this time.
Yeah.
2024 gave us a special look that even 2017 didn't give us, right? We're at the peak of a solar cycle, so we had more activity for you to actually see and study, correct?
We are near a solar maximum. I don't think they're at the exact maximum absolute peak right now, but I heard several of the heliophysicists walking around talking about how it's very active and around a maximum or something to that nature. It's, I never want to try to come off as an expert in whatever it is that we're studying at the time. Because like I said, I may be doing eclipse work this week and I collect all that data and I make sure I understand enough about it. If I happen to lose comms while I'm up there, I can give them the best data that I possibly can. But then that gets handed off and that goes and people go and process that for years. and then I'm done with it. And then I got to start thinking about the next mission. And if it's an imaging mission, we do enough of those, we really understand that. But then when it's the atmospheric science missions, we got to go and dig into that and look at what is it they're trying to learn? How do we do that? What if we lose comms? We're going up and down through different layers of the atmosphere. How fast do we need to keep doing that? So you've got to be able to shift gears quickly. All right, I was doing this, now I'm doing that. And then you hand the data off, and then you move on. It's very similar to what the astronauts have to do. They can be an expert in a certain field, but they each have to be able to move on to another task or learn about something that they haven't done before.
So, Tony, I want to break and we'll come back. I want to ask you some other questions because it's obvious and that you're a man of faith. And, you know, we've talked about this on the show so many times about, you know, the pursuit of science. You know, is God revealing himself? There's scripture that supports that. And then for some reason, only in a fallen creation could humans be convinced that, no, the pursuit of science is to rule God out as opposed to see him and watch his hand. I want to talk to you about the spiritual component of the things you see when we come back on Rick and Bubba University, the podcast. So Patriot Mobile, they teamed up with the Rick and Bubba show. Bubba, they're on the big show now,
yep,
too.
Yep.
We got folks out there that, and we understand this, we struggle just like you guys do, when we're trying to look about spending our money with people that go out and then they take stands that we don't agree with. And we're like, wow, am I financing this worldview? Am I financing this? And sometimes you go, well, I don't really have a choice. But when it comes to your wireless provider, good news, you do. Patriot Mobile is, and they have been for a while, America's only Christian conservative wireless provider. They're the only one. And when you switch to Patriot Mobile, you send a message. You're like, you know what? I don't have to send my money to things I don't agree with. I want to send my money to a wireless provider that supports free speech, religious freedom, the sanctity of life, Second Amendment. I want to send my money to a wireless company that supports our military, that takes care of our veterans, our first responder heroes. They have a 100% U.S.-based customer service team, and they make switching so very easy. Do you want to keep your number? That's fine. Do you want to keep your phone? That's also cool. But if you want to upgrade, their team will help you do that, and they'll find the best plan for your needs. And you can get activated for free because you have made the right decision to listen to or watch Rick and Bubba University, the podcast. Go to patriotmobile.com/Rick Bubba. Just put our names together with no and. patriotmobile.com/Rick Bubba. Or you can call them for free activation, 972-PATRIOT, and mention our code, Rick Bubba. Why don't you join, by the tens of thousands now that are making the switch to Patriot Mobile today. Rick and Bubba University, the podcast. Tony Casey, our guest. So, Tony has the honor of flying on the WB-57. We talked about this, this incredible machine, and how we have adapted it to now doing research. When you get to go to 63,000 feet and you get to see this solar eclipse that you just saw, and you talked about how everything's got to line up the way it does, you see the northern lights, all these things you've studied about our creation, our Earth and its relationship with the rest of the universe, et cetera. The Apostle Paul says that nobody has an excuse when it comes to God's existence because God has clearly revealed himself in creation. But in all fairness, we have some people that take a different point of view, that the pursuit of this kind of science in their mind is to rule out the existence of God. What say you, Tony Casey, on your own experience?
Well, through my experience, through the second law of thermodynamics to start with, is nothing orders itself by itself. It's entropy, actually first law, sorry. So anytime I see everything placed in order and placed in a configuration that is so intricately interwoven, I would have a hard time. I did struggle with my faith at some point. It happens pretty commonly in college.
Sure.
And ever since then, it came to my realization that science was originally started to try to study the creation in order to better understand the creator.
Correct. Yep.
And that's the approach that I take. So anytime I see some of these views that a lot of humans don't ever get the chance to see with their own eyes, I look at it as just getting a different perspective at another piece of creation. I've seen a thunderstorm from way above and how the lightning dances around and interacts, and seeing the eclipse. And while I didn't get a lot of time just to like look up and enjoy it, because I was too busy trying to get everybody the science that they needed. Again, the just the right size moon, just the right distance from the Earth, just to block out the primary portion of the sun and give that darkness. It's humbling, and it lets me just understand a little bit more about, hey, we all need to try to find some common ground here. And this creator has put us all here and put all these, everything from the ants that do what they do to the moon and its glory. The sun that powers the whole thing, we're trying to understand that better. Light, good. That was pretty simple in Genesis. So I don't know. It's that's my, I guess, overall thought on it.
Yeah, it's one of those things that happenstance, the more we're allowed to study, happenstance just seems so unlikely.
Well, like you said, Tony, the recurring pattern of things, when you look at the way an atom is built, up to a molecule, up to, you know, our solar system, and then the actual galaxy that our solar system's in, and, you know, you can just keep pulling this out, and some of this is on the very far edge of science now, but I mean, some of these galaxies and super clusters appear to be in spherical helical patterns, which would also replicate our DNA. And that, you know, that's just, I mean, I don't know how that can be accidental.
Yeah, I concur with you. I've made a lot of accidents in my life, and I've never done anything that come to anything that looked good like that. So no. That's the only way I know how to look at it, I guess.
Yeah, all my bad decisions never led to order.
No.
It just never led to chaos.
Tony, I know you guys, as you had pointed out, you fly a lot of different type of missions. So is there a scientific mission that you have not been on that you would like to fly, or that you think would be cool to fly on?
I think anything studying the atmosphere over Hawaii would be great. I'm really looking forward to when we get to go somewhere fun. Right. Either it's the Arctic or the desert, you know, a tropical island. Maybe it would be some fun science. Maybe check it out. I tan up pretty nicely. So, let's see. The science component, I just kind of take those as it goes. I'm really the imagery expert guy. I came to be in this job by working with that nose system that was originally built for the shuttle launches and returns, and now, like I say, continue to be modified. And as far as those missions go, I've gotten to work all the big ones that have come along so far. I've got to do the first one of the starships. I did the first SLS that launched, and the Artemis, the capsule returned when it came back. Those are kind of my big punch card items. Yeah. The other SEOs, we've joked about making ourselves a bingo card, or the Trunk Monkey Mafia, as we refer to ourselves. We are
funny.
Trunk Monkey.
Hey,
Bubba.
Hey, one of my favorite commercial series
forever.
Yeah.
Now, what was the logo you've got there?
Is it a Trunk Monkey?
It's a tactical Trunk Monkey.
Oh, that is great.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Look, he's got his mask on.
Isn't that
cool?
Fantastic.
Now, that is a logo, my friend.
Bubba, what a
great
day.
So, we're going to make us a bingo card about done something that exploded. Has done this, has done that. So we've had a pretty wide array of missions. I'm looking forward to the next one, which is the Boeing CFT launch and return. We're not filming the launch. We're on standby in case they have an issue and they have to come back early. But then the mission is supposed to come back around the middle, early part of May. Just Sunny and, I cannot remember the other astronaut saying that's going up on it. And you know, that's the Boeing capsule that lands out in the desert and lands on land with airbags. And I'm actually going to be tasked to image that mission.
So, Tony, let me ask you this question. And again, I know that because of your line of work, if there's ever a question that you go, I just can't comment on that. That's okay. But we won't know till we ask. So you're flying with, as you said, some of the finest pilots that the world has to offer, which is very comforting. So you guys have a lot of missions, and Bubba and I have always adopted this. I don't get nervous at all unless I look and the person who's really, really good at what they're doing seems to be concerned. You know, like if I'm on a ship and everybody that works on the ship looks calm and I might think it's a little rocky, I'm fine. If I'm deep sea fishing and I look and the captain seems to be laughing and I think, man, is this kind of rough? And I see he's fine. But I do recall that one time that I was in a chartered little jet, a Citation jet, and I'll never forget, and I want to, but I can't, when the pilot looked over his shoulder and hollered, "Hang on." I knew then that what was going to happen next was not going to be pleasant, because he seemed to be intense because he was about to go to work, and he instructed all of us to hang on. Have you had any of those situations on any of this where you were like, well, that was an interesting ride?
Since the time I have been flying, I have not. But I will say that one of my best guys, work friends here, who's the SEO that taught me probably the most of all the guys, one of his first flights or one of his earliest flights was and he was in the Marines. He was a ground comms guy in the Marines, Don Darrow, great guy, great friend of mine. And so he's seen a lot of stuff. And he was flying over Afghanistan, and the aircraft had some issues. Mm. And his pilot was also you can't say former Marine because there are no such things.
That's right.
He was
right.
In the Marines as a pilot. And I get some of the stories mixed up here. It's either him or another guy that had a problem. But it was the same guy in the front. It's like, train, are we okay? Pilot's call sign, train. And and his only response came back was, busy.
Yeah.
That's not what you want to hear.
No.
That's when you start, you put your tray away. Yeah. You do all the things you've got to do. You get a good ejection posture.
Yeah.
You tuck your elbows in.
Yeah. Well, I often, on mine, which, you know, was just on a small plane, but I still remember it so vividly, a friend of mine that was sitting across from me, you know, the seats that are facing you. And I can still remember, he's a powerful man of God. He said, "I'm not afraid to die, but I am not crazy about the process."
Yeah.
And he's like, is this the day? And I said, "I'm not the expert. I don't know. But let's just hang on." But we did get through it.
Go Tony, ahead. In a case like that, a worst-case scenario, do you eject yourself or does the pilot eject both of you?
Oh, there you go.
So we each have an ejection handle. And the way the system in this aircraft works is we each have a safe and an arm and a pull to eject handle. And if either one of them is armed and either one of us pulls the handle, everybody's going.
Uh-oh.
So I could show it's safe, but then accidentally, but it takes about 40 pounds of force and a couple inches of pulls. So it's nothing you're going to accidentally bump. Thank goodness. I'm still scared of the thing. Like I treat it like it's poison.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want anything to do with it. But if we have to, say, drink a lot of water and have to use one of the relief bags or something, I was like, hey, can we safe these up for a few minutes just as a precaution? We would both go. It blows the canopy off. The flight controls get severed to pull the yoke forward because it's such a big aircraft. It actually has a yoke, which is not common on ejection aircraft. Normally they have a stick, so they don't have anything to hit the pilot's legs. So that gets pulled forward. And then the backseater goes out to the right, because the SEO is always right. And then the pilot goes over to the left to try to get some lateral separation as well as vertical separation. That's about a half second difference, but we don't go that fast. So you want to give yourself every opportunity to make sure you don't have a problem in flight. Part of the training that we have to go through is not so much about the ejection process. We have to go through that and understand that. And we train in a dummy seat every year, but some of the biggest thing that honestly I had a problem with was I had to go through survival training with the Air Force before I could start flying, or not, but within the first year. That was tough because I was 44 at the time and not the best knees in the world.
Yeah. We'll come back. We'll finish our conversation with Tony Casey when Rick and Bubba University, the podcast, continues right after this.
This is the Rick and Bubba Show. Watch more at blazetv.com/Rick and Bubba.
Rick and Bubba, Rick and Bubba.
Tony Casey, our guest on Rick and Bubba University, the podcast. He is the WB-57 Flight Crew Sensor Equipment Operation and Imaging Mission Specialist with NASA. And it has been a fascinating conversation with him And Bubba, I know that we have a lot to ask, but I want to ask one more thing, something you've been talking about on the big show. And since, you know, Tony has looked at the sun and been around the sun and a moment further back in the podcast, Tony, you were talking about using temperatures around the sun. At one time, you're using thousands of degrees. Then you're talking about millions of degrees. And Bubba has talked about on the show, and I think what he says makes a lot of sense. Does it seem like maybe the fact that this gigantic, burning hot ball in the sky and our relationship to it could have a lot more to do with extreme climate throughout the Earth's history as opposed to cows breaking wind?
I will say that there are a lot of variables at play.
Right.
And this huge reaction is certainly one of them. Our distance to it is one of them. I was watching a video the other day talking about Newton's three body problem, where if you've got two objects in gravitational orbit or pull around each other, we understand it. As soon as you start introducing more of them, it's really hard to model and understand. And they had taken Mercury and moved it by a few millimeters. And in a small number, but a notable number of the simulations, then it wrecked the entire inner solar system. So relative spacing, the distance, rotation, tilt, what kind of cycle the sun's in, all these things can affect life here on Earth, which is a very important reason to then study the sun. I think we should, I've heard you guys say this, we should be good stewards of this place that we
have. Of course. Right.
But to think that we are important and powerful enough to be the sole factor that is in charge of everything, good or bad, that's happening, that's pretty lofty. That's pretty self-important. And I don't feel like we're that. We should definitely do the best we can with the garden that we've been given to work. And that's all we can do. And trying to understand the rest of it's always a good venture, but that's about where it stops in my mind.
Tony, so have you, while you are flying, have you ever got any real good pictures of the ice wall?
Ice walls or no. A lot of people like, look, hey, I know y'all get better ratings when we talk about UFOs. You want to ask me about this? I've seen any.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything that I can't talk about, but if I'd seen them, I couldn't tell you. So
I know.
So there you go. It's a bad issue.
It feels like questions going nowhere. Yeah.
So
yeah, I know, but we just mentioned UFOs, so maybe that'll help the ratings.
Oh, that's right.
That's 10,000 more views right there.
See, we can list that now in the subject line of things we talked about. So,
or UAPs?
Yeah. I wish we'd go back to UFOs.
Yeah,
I grew up with that. I really don't want to change the designator at this point. Tony, you told us how you got there. For other young people that are watching this and say, you know, this sounds like something I want to get into. I would like to try. I want to go. What is the best path to get there? What would you tell them today?
I'll tell you to take the opportunities, and that's the biggest thing, and never think anything's out of reach. They just closed the last astronaut class, and I really debated on applying for it, but just at 47 and with my knees, I decided not to. I think I've reached the mental portion of my head where I could probably be good at that job now, but the physical decline is just not going to keep up with it. By the time I'd actually be, if I were selected and trained to go through everything else, I'd be 50 going into space, and I'd rather be in my recliner at that point.
Yeah.
So, but if I would have known then that it's not just pilots or military they're looking for anymore, they're looking for people with education and science and math and that like to solve problems and go out and get on the verge of things. So if you are in that field and are interested by this stuff, look at those astronaut qualifications, because you could probably get there faster than you think. I'd say roughly half maybe of our current astronauts are pilots, and I really didn't even look at it that much because I thought that was a limitation for me. For me, it's also, by the way, the weight limit is like 210 pounds. So that's a long way away.
Yeah.
But pursue the sciences. I came out of college with a physics degree only. And really my plan had been to continue on and get something in engineering. And I had to leave Auburn, chose to leave Auburn before I'd kind of completed that plan. But I wound up going back and getting it later as I worked. So even if you get a job, you can continue your education, work towards the things that interest you. If opportunities arise that are even related to a field that's interesting or curious to you, do it. Because when I first started working around this aircraft, they're like, there's no way you'd ever get to fly in this thing. Like, you're just down here doing the measurement on this, and you're just keeping this thing working. And then people would look at me like I was crazy when I said I wanted to fly in it, because they're like, it's really not the like newest, sleekest, most awesome jet in the world. If you want to fly in that thing, I'm like, absolutely. So don't let anybody tell you you're crazy. Keep pursuing your education. Take the best of every opportunity. Raise your hand. Step forward. Be the weird guy that just makes your own interview, and or girl, and stand out. That's the biggest thing. Just stand out in whatever way you can.
So the Earth isn't flat.
Zero flatness. You can even see in some of those pictures I sent. Yeah. You can see the curvature from.
Tony? Are you a little amazed at this point along that some of these things still linger, the flat Earth people? And
how is that possible?
Some of these things that I thought we were kind of beyond that, you know.
There's no scientific way it could possibly be flat. I am amazed. I am just, I'm like, you can't be serious. You've got to really be joking, right? You got to be hanging on to some haha, making a joke thing, because it makes no sense to me whatsoever how somebody could still think it's flat. Everything else out there is round and spherical. We form things in spherical. I mean, it's the first thing you do when you get a thing of Play-Doh, right? It's just natural. You want to make a ball out of it. I don't get it. But the social network, I guess.
Social dilemma.
Yes. Thank you. It really, I guess that explained it as good as anything.
You know, one of my favorite memes on it has been the one that has the whole solar system and it's the planets and they're all round and it has Earth as a pizza pan and they go, well, this is embarrassing.
But like you said, the first time I remember, you know, it's been in the last, 5 years? I remember the first time someone called and brought it up. I honestly thought, well, this is funny. Good job bringing something funny to the show.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you start getting peppered with more calls and your emails start coming in and you think, wait a minute, are y'all serious? And then I'm like you, Tony and Bubba, I do think social dilemma kind of explained it as we wall people off into this little world where all they hear are people that think the Earth is flat.
And feed them what the algorithms think they want to hear.
But how does it feel now to know that when you're trying to scientifically show people things now, but we're in a time now where people can look right at something and you say, here is truth, and they still reject it. I mean, it's a weird time that we're in.
I got enough problems to worry about between keeping the horses fed and the sensors working. I don't cast my pearls at swine. I just,
there you go.
I say, you said a lot of words there, and just I kind of going about my way. It's not something I really encounter that much in my daily life. I don't interact a whole lot on social media, kind of for that reason. I'll post some pictures. I'll try to let some old friends know what I'm up to, and I just move on about my day.
That's wise. I've adopted on my 60th birthday coming up this year that I will no longer, for the rest of the life God allows me, try to reason with unreasonable people.
Well, it just seems like a bad use of time.
I don't. I don't know what.
Well, I can't totally do that because I do have three daughters, so they're going to be unreasonable at some point.
Yeah. Oh, listen. There's probably days you want to go flying in that jet.
Yeah.
Hey, my quiet time out at the barn would start every morning, where it's just me and the animals out there, and the sun's coming up. And lady, you want some help? Nope. I'm good. I'm good.
All good.
Well, what a great visit, Tony, and we're so thankful you took time to be with us. Thank you for the research that you're doing. We're excited to see what you guys are going to continue to let us know about what we did discover during the solar eclipse. So we're looking forward to all that. And thank you so much for being so kind to us and giving us airtime on the big show and also taking time to be with us today.
And if you're in the neighborhood, come see us.
I'll come see you, and I'll bring you some WB patches.
Yes, please.
And maybe I can get me a WB, a Rick and Bubba t-shirt in exchange. How about that?
You know
we
what?
Can do that. Especially that Trump monkey patch.
Yeah, that Trump monkey patch.
That's a good
one. I hate to use – I'm going to have to use the term you had us at hello there. So Tony, thank you, and thank you, NASA, for allowing Tony to be on with us. The WB-57 flight crew sensor equipment operator and imaging mission specialist. And basically, he told all of you out there that are maybe aspiring to do something similar, just keep always volunteering for what's next and be willing to make a play when you get the opportunity.
That's right.
There you go. Tony, thanks for being with us. And thanks to each and every one of you for joining us on this edition of Rick and Bubba University, the podcast.